From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with ethicist Benjamin Weicker about a number of critical issues, including natural law and climate change. Let's now join Hank as he introduces Dr. Weicker.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. I don't know how we can keep upping the ante, but that's precisely what we're doing. This week is particularly interesting to me because this is a conversation with Benjamin Weicker. Now, he doesn't have many kids. I have 12. He only has 7. But other than that, he is a graduate from Furman University. He has an MA in religion. He has a PhD in theological ethics from Vanderbilt University. He's a senior fellow at the Veritas Center for Ethics and Public Life at the Franciscan University. He's director of human life studies at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. And he's published all kinds of very interesting books. One of the books that really caught my attention early on was A Meaningful World, but there are many others, and we'll talk about that on today's Hank Unplugged. It is an absolute delight to have you with us, Benjamin.
And I'm so glad to be back. I remember our interview in Meaningful World is one of the best I've ever engaged in. So when y'all invited me on, I was very excited. So this is a highlight of certainly of my week.
You know, when you talk about A Meaningful World, you're talking about a book, but that book underscores how the arts and the sciences reveal the genius of nature. And that's something that somehow or other has escaped our attention.
Yes, it's unfortunate we live in a kind of a secularized, materialist-based culture, and that supposedly is undergirded by science. Science tells you that you live in a reductionist, materialist world, and hence there isn't any meaning in the universe, but that's just not true. When we actually look at the way that science carries on and the way that it uncovers layers and layers of complex intelligibility, you begin to realize, this couldn't have happened by accident. We don't live in a meaningless world. We live in a meaningful world, and we uncover those layers of intelligibility in every one of the sciences. So we're in this weird situation where everyone's telling us the science tells us there's no God, and we live in a meaningless universe, but science is actually telling us, if we shake off the shackles that are binding our minds, that we live in a meaningful world, and it's deeply intelligible, and hence has to have an intelligent source.
You know, I just wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. It's not out till October 10th this year, 2017. But I want to talk to you a little bit about what's happening around the world. You seem to have your finger on the pulse of persecution. I've heard you point out that the greatest century for martyrdom was not the Roman centuries, but the modern centuries, like the 20th and 21st centuries, and that in the 21st century alone, we have martyrdom of Christians at a rate of about 100,000 per year. And I think this is something that is in the blind spot of the West, and we need to talk about.
Yeah, you wonder, how could that be happening yet be ignored? And there's a lot of strange causes of it. One of them is rather complex, but I'll try to boil it down. And probably you pick right up on that in your new book, which I will be very happy to read, by the way. That there is a kind of built-in anti-Christian, pro-Muslim bias that's actually hundreds of years old. It goes back to the late 1600s to the original radical secularists in Europe who wanted to unseat Christianity, and they thought that Islam was actually a better religion. And so they were willing to believe everything good about Islam and everything bad about Christianity. And that sort of sounds like the secular left today. It doesn't sort of sound like it. That's how they are. They ignore any obvious bad news when it happens against Christians, and then they downplay anything bad that the Muslims do, and then they put a, you know, a cheerful face on Islam, when at the foundation of it, it truly is antagonistic both to Christianity and to secular culture. So this is a very odd blind spot that I don't know how we can, you know, make it more obvious, but Christians need to make it known loud and clear that this is an age of martyrdom. It's one of the worst.
It is, and you think about how many Christians are being martyred in the Middle East. I mean, sometimes we think that North Korea is the greatest persecutor of Christians, but the greatest persecution of Christians seems to be rooted in Islamic countries.
Yes. And here's another aspect. Again, the secular left is quite loud, and rightly so, about the sin of slavery. And it thinks that it's only something that the Christian West did. And that's just not true. Islam is much more deeply embedded in slave trade, both in entire history and up until now. And the greatest cause of slavery, well, there's two of them now. It's Islam, and then it's the sexual slavery in regard to pornography. And Islam is, you know, as you know, basically has reinstated a kind of sexual slavery which we thought we had wiped out, but it's not true. It's right there. And again, they're ignoring that. How can they ignore that or the way that women are treated generally? But again, it's this self-imposed blind spot. Christianity can't be better than Islam. That would undo our whole historical narrative, so they think.
Think about how if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately, as has been well said. How important is it for us to have a conversation with the Protestant community, the Orthodox community, the Catholic community? How can we find commonality around the essentials? Because we're being attacked by illiberal liberalism, that we have the onslaught of Islam, and we're in a very precarious position. Obviously, we're in that position because if we are not salt and light, pagans are going to exercise their job description, and we're going to be in the situation that we find ourselves in today. But talk about how unity, not at the expense of the essentials, is really critical for us to be looking forward to as Christians.
It is. It really is. And the 500th year of the anniversary of the Reformation, you know, I believe that God is actually driving us back all together again, because as you say, all Christians are being persecuted by the secular left. All Christians are being persecuted by Islam. And I like to use the image, because I'm a big Tolkien fan, of the elves and the dwarves in Helm's Deep, you know, and they've had this centuries-long antagonism to each other, and they can't get along, but they're driven into this castle because they're being attacked by a common enemy, and they learn to be friends. And, you know, the dwarves don't turn into elves, the elves don't turn into dwarves, but they realize they have a common enemy, and they can have a common friendship based on the some of the essentials. And we're in that situation today. Every Christian is under attack. And when Christians are under attack by Islam in the areas around the Holy Land and Syria and Iraq and so on, well, we're all under attack. It isn't those people over there, and it's all Christians. And all Christians were assaulted by communism in the 20th century. You know, the communists didn't single out, we're just going to hit the Eastern Orthodox, or we're just going to hit the Roman Catholics, or we're just going to hit Lutherans. You know, they were enemies to all Christians, and that should let us know we must have something if these people see us as their chief enemy. We must have something good in common. And while we don't want to override differences and say, hey, they're not essential, we can at least say if we aren't in this together, then we will all commonly be defeated. No one will win then.
How do you overcome the stereotypes, though? I mean, in the broader evangelical community, certainly in the dispensational community, the Roman Catholic Church is seen as the Whore of Babylon that is depicted in Revelation chapter 17. I know when I converted to Orthodoxy, people didn't know what that was, but they're pretty sure they didn't like it. There's these stereotypes that are out there. How do you overcome that?
Well, whatever it is, it's got to be bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's one of the things, and I stress this in the Reformation 500 years later, everyone's got dirt. And there's a kind of humility if we can all realize that we've all made mistakes, Protestant, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and nobody is without sin, and hence, you know, we really shouldn't be casting stones. And for heaven's sakes, if we're told by Jesus Christ to love your enemies, can't we even love our fellow Christians? You know, if we have to have a battle, let it be one of charity. To outlove each other, as we might put it. So we do have to overcome those. And one of the things I do in the Reformation 500 years later is I have something there for everyone, a little humility pill. I do look at the popes, the really bad popes. Yes, there were really bad popes, and Catholics have to understand that. But I also look at very good popes, and Protestants have to understand that, and what they did that was important. I look at Martin Luther, warts and all, and there's a significant number of warts there. I look at the problems caused by different interpretations of Scripture once the principle of sola scriptura was embraced. So I think one of the things that we all need is humility, and that can be the beginning of saying, you know, I'm not without sin. Again, I'm not going to cast the first rock, but I can reach out to my Catholic, I can make Catholic friends and reach out. I can make Protestant friends, reach out to them. Eastern Orthodox, reach out to them. And we'll find that we have a lot more in common, especially when we're all under fire, than we have which divides us.
In Defense of Nature, you know, I just read that book, the subtitle, The Catholic Unity of Environmental, Economic, and Moral Ecology. You've written a lot of great books, but this has to be at the top of my list. I mean, first of all, I love the subject. Secondly, I love the way you wrote this book. I mean, it's absolutely hilarious at some points, but what you do here is you're doing probably what's most needed today. You're pointing out that there is a way to bridge the gap between the left and the right so that we can have a meaningful dialogue.
Yes. Yes, and we're not having that now. That's the problem. And we can put the blame on both sides. The left is really good at seeing the awfulness of befouling nature. They get it. The problem is that they unite that with things that Christians find repugnant, usually morally repugnant, everything from gay marriage to theologically repugnant, like some kind of either atheism or pantheism or some weird combination. So you've got something good there, the affirmation of nature as good and ordered, but something off, the belief that you can do anything you want to human nature and there isn't any moral foundation. Well, you find among Christians the opposite. You tend to find the opposite. They shy away from any questions on the environment because they think they're dipping a toe into pantheism or worse, and they simply want to embrace Christianity as a kind of moral theological set of moral theological doctrines abstracted from nature. Well, that's a weird situation to be in from the perspective. I know you know this from the history of Christianity. That's a heresy called Gnosticism. You know, one thing that's essential to Christianity, obvious from the Incarnation, is that we're embodied beings, we're natural beings, we're created in the image of God, but we're animals, that is, we're rational animals, we're part of nature, but we also transcend nature, and the point of In Defense of Nature is to get the left and the right to see what the other side is saying that's true that you're rejecting. So get the left to see that there's a moral order to human nature. You just can't do whatever you want sexually in the same way you can't do whatever you want to the environment. And the right or Christians have to see, wait a second, isn't there something in the Bible about the goodness of creation? Isn't there something in the Bible about how the beauty and the order and the wisdom of creation is an argument for God's existence? It just leads us to God's existence. So on the Christian side of things, again, we should be leading the environmental movement, and if you don't like what the left is doing with the environmental movement, let's blame it on ourselves for not being there to lead them more coherently and correctly.
So you're saying that the left is obsessed with the pollution of the natural environment. If you go to the right, you have an obsession with the pollution of the moral environment, and each side is satisfied with a half-truth as though the half-truth constituted a whole truth.
Yeah.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Benjamin Weicker. The left understands the exquisite, delicate harmony of the natural order and why environmental pollution is harmful. The right understands the exquisite, delicate harmony of the human moral order and why moral pollution is harmful. Yet each side refuses to see the other's argument. Dr. Weicker's book, In Defense of Nature, allows both the left and the right to see what the other sees so clearly and how it all fits together, from toxic landfills and global warming to internet addiction and human trafficking. To receive your copy of Benjamin Weicker's In Defense of Nature as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's mind-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, osteenification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master. Not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Osteenification of American Christianity. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank invited ethicist Benjamin Weicker to discuss his book, In Defense of Nature. Well, let's rejoin Hank and Professor Weicker in their conversation.
So you're saying that the left is obsessed with the pollution of the natural environment. If you go to the right, you have an obsession with the pollution of the moral environment, and each side is satisfied with a half-truth as though the half-truth constituted a whole truth.
Yes, and it's going to be painful. I think it's maybe more painful for the left. I sort of have the hope, please God, that we can get Christians to understand this, because the goodness of nature should be one of the central doctrines. I mean, God is a creator of nature. He's the creator and redeemer. And so we should be making that move first. But also, again, as you say, the left, it's got half that truth, but it doesn't want to admit that the moral order that Christians uphold is really a natural order. It's not a revealed truth to say that men should marry women. That's, you would think, sort of naturally obvious. Also, that you don't want to kill your unborn or born children. Things like that are appealing to the natural good that we should accept, and the left has to understand that moral order is just as fragile and real and natural and to be protected as the environmental order.
I think it's interesting for maybe this discussion to talk about what natural law is to begin with. A lot of people hear that moniker, not all that certain what it means, what it entails.
Yeah, and boy, if there's ever a weed bed of confusion, it's the natural law. We have a bad understanding of law. I could probably talk for about an hour on that, so I won't. But we think of it as some kind of an order from somebody, like God orders you not to murder, or God orders you not to commit adultery. And what the natural law argues, and this is essential to the history of Christianity, is that the moral order of human beings is rooted in their very nature. It's not something imposed on it. It's something that defines the intrinsic order and perfection of human nature. So do not murder comes from the fact that human beings quite literally are the only rational animal made in the image of God capable of moral actions. So that's, you know, that's what the natural law is. It's not something extrinsic to human beings. It's intrinsic. And unfortunately, there was a, I guess we in modern parlance call it a branding problem. It would have been better to call it something else rather than the natural law, because it sounds like what we today call laws of nature. But in defense of nature, I try to shake people loose from this and talk about trout law, or you could talk about squirrel law, or you could talk about turtle law. And all you would be talking about is, well, what is a turtle? What does it need to live well and perfect itself, and what harms it? And that's all you're talking about with natural law in regard to human beings. What is a human being? What makes it distinct? What makes it flourish? And what harms it? And so in defense of nature, I go through that as if you could, and you can, discover this sort of from an ecological standpoint. You really can uncover the basics of the natural law. Here is a human being. What is good for it as a human being? How do you perfect its nature? What harms it? That's the foundation of the Christian understanding of moral law.
You know, trout law would probably be a good thing to cash out, because it's really easy to understand, but becomes an example of how when you defy the parameters that God sets forth for us to live within, we reap the consequences.
Yeah, and so let's use the example of a trout. We'll use a freshwater trout. That freshwater trout can't live in salt water. That freshwater trout will actually die if a nearby industrial plant pours hot water into the stream and the temperature rises higher. In the same way that if you raise the temperature around human beings too high, they'll die too. So if I purposely sneak in your house and, you know, try to bake you, well, that's against human law. You know, that's against the natural law because it's a harm. And another thing that's interesting, by the way, that's happened to, I don't know whether it's happened to trout, but to other fish, you know, fish are supposed to mate. That's how they get more fish. It's part of their nature to mate. And because so many women have taken the pill for so long, it gets into the streams through our sewer systems and is actually, if I can say this this way, transgendering the fish. That is, the males can no longer mate, and the fish populations are dying out because of that. Now, that's against the nature of a trout. We're violating trout law. And I like that example because every environmentally concerned person must say, well, that's not a good thing. Why? That's a bad thing. That's an example of pollution that harms the nature of this creature. It goes against its nature and causes it not to be able to do something it should be doing, and that is mating. Well, this is weird. We don't think that the pill, and we don't think that sexual transgenderism, and we don't think that sterility purposely caused and so on are violations of the human sexual moral order, even when we find them in nature, and every environmentalist is going to say, this is bad. You shouldn't be dumping these chemicals into the fish. You're ruining their ability to be that kind of a fish. So, again, if we can use those examples, hopefully they awaken the left to moral questions in regard to human beings as well.
Really, what you're pointing out is the connectivity between environmental ecology and ethical ecology.
Absolutely. And when one of the chapters in Defense of Nature, I deal with trash. Because we create so much of it, but that ties us into questions about economics. That is, are we setting up an economic system which literally causes the defamation, the violation, the profanation of the land, and also poisons the groundwater, and on top of everything else, looks bad. That is, makes creation befouled in front of us. And so that's a kind of pollution, and everyone has to say, well, that what else would it be? But I also have a chapter on sexual pollution in which I use all the same terms and talk about how you can measure the harm, and it's not just some kind of vague moral thing the Christians made up. It's we can literally see that our sexual activities are causing a kind of pollution of human nature. So when you can see both issues side by side and you can see that you're using the same kind of analysis and you can see that scientists are pointing to the harm caused both by our treatment of the environment and to our sexual nature, well, then you see this web of reasoning. It's really one kind of reasoning that we're using, and it's not rarefied. It's not purely Christian. It's something that's available to everyone as a foundation for which we can hopefully begin a reasonable public debate on these things.
You know, let's go back to this idea of the big business of garbage. I know it's sort of personal to you because of where you live and what you've experienced where you live. And I don't really know how to cash all of this out, but you think about New York, and New York's garbage suddenly disappears mysteriously, but it ends up somewhere. And so, as you pointed out, there's a trickle-down trash effect that's going on around the world, and recycling is not what we think it is, and perhaps doesn't really work in the way we think it works.
No, I'll deal with the trash aspect first. As you say, this is personal for me. It still actually is. In the book, In Defense of Nature, I talk about my experience. We lived out in a cabin in the woods, and it was so wonderful. And here, not a mile down the road, these enormous trainloads, 100-car trainloads of trash were coming in and parking there, waiting to get into the landfill that was a few miles away, and it smelled awful. And that wasn't our trash. Okay, granted, I contributed some trash to that, but what's actually happening, and this happens all over the world, is that the rich or places in the city places, like New York City, are transporting their trash elsewhere. So it looks like it magically disappears, and it's not a problem. And what they don't have to face is how much junk, how much waste they produce. And I tweak New York because it is obviously a liberal center, intellectual and social center, but they have no cause for self-satisfaction because we here in Ohio simply receive all of their trash. And that's sort of a morally bankrupt position because they're not being honest about what they themselves are doing. Even where we are now, we smell another landfill when the wind's right, and the wind's right all too often because they're concentrating trash in such enormous, tonnage in this area. So what you find is that the rich places who love to spout off about how wonderful they are actually sending their trash to the poor places, to the places where people are out of work, they have areas that people don't care what you do with them, we're the ones suffering for it. So you've got that awful situation where the moral effect of what you're really doing isn't visible to you. And that's not good. It's a lot like we don't see what's going on in those factories over in China or India or elsewhere where they're making our super inexpensive clothes. But that's not morally defensible, and think how much of the Old and New Testament deals with how you treat the poor. So there you've got a theological aspect to it. So there's so many aspects to the environmental argument, and trash is certainly, you know, one of the things that many people overlook because they don't have to deal with it. Now, there was another half to your question. Bring that to my mind again.
I can't even remember what the other half of my question was.
Okay, maybe my answer was too long.
No, actually, what I was asking about is the whole issue of recycling. I mean, how does recycling actually work? Because it's really not what we think it is. I mean, you go into the airport and you see the recycling, the differences between the recycling container and the waste container. And we think we have an idea of how this works in some sanitized sense, but it doesn't really work that way.
It doesn't. And this was a really depressing part of the book to research because, you know, we've been recycling for years and years and years. We have our little special cans and so on, and we still do it. You know, we still do it. But what causes the need for recycling is that we just consume too much stuff. We just create so much trash, so much packaging and so on. And it's really expensive environmentally to do that. And it ends up in landfills. Now, it might seem like we'll just recycle everything. And so we put it in a little box, and then I put it in the recycling bin, and I feel better. And I still do. I can still trick myself. But as you're pointing out, the sad news is that recycling only pays if you've got really poor people on the other end who dig through the stuff and sort through it, usually in very bad conditions.
We'll pick up Hank's conversation with Professor Benjamin Weicker in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth, and receive your copy of Benjamin Weicker's book, In Defense of Nature, The Catholic Unity of Environmental, Economic, and Moral Ecology, as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. hankunplugged.org. We'll be back after the break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview with ethicist Benjamin Weicker on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. From the outside, Houston preacher Joel Osteen is charming, attractive, and his teaching, well, it makes you feel good. But the truth is, Osteen preaches a seductive and highly dangerous form of Christianity that's leading millions of people astray. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity, and it's why you must get your own copy today. You must be able to defend yourself with truth about what Joel Osteen really teaches. And this important resource arms you with everything you need to do so. Please call today and request your copy of The Osteenification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're bringing you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank invited ethicist Benjamin Weicker to discuss his book, In Defense of Nature. Let's rejoin the conversation as Dr. Weicker explains how recycling really works.
The sad news is that recycling only pays if you've got really poor people on the other end who dig through the stuff and sort through it, usually in very bad conditions. Now, there are some recycling plants in the United States that are better than that, but most of the recycling that we do, you can talk about electronics, like your computer, your phone, all that stuff, they're sent back to China because we don't manufacture anything for China. They manufacture everything for us. They send over these big ships full of goods that we buy, but they're empty. So we overconsume and we don't produce anything. And these ships that the Chinese send over, which had all our goods in them, if they went back empty, they'd actually be dangerous because they need weight in them. So it, oddly enough, pays then to dump all our recycling on the Chinese. So that's where a whole lot of it goes. It's shipped back to China, and if you would look at some of the places in China where they do this recycling, you're talking about the poorest of the poor who sort through this stuff under the worst conditions because that's the only way they can make money. And they are the ones who are doing the actual recycling. It isn't the happy recycling elves. It's poor people. And it doesn't matter what you're recycling. You can see electronics, same thing. Under horrible conditions, they're stripping those electronic devices of anything they can get, usually the precious metals, but they're doing it under conditions which are cheap and hence dangerous and toxic. So bringing back the J.R.R. Tolkien metaphor, the places they recycle look like Mordor because literally they're toxified and the people there are toxified as well. So if we actually had to pay for recycling, we'd find out it wouldn't pay. If we actually made sure that everyone did it under conditions that were safe, it wouldn't pay. And the answer isn't to stop recycling and then just have more junk. It's we need to look at the way we consume so much and why so much comes in so much packaging. Recycling isn't the answer. It's what you do when you haven't yet looked at the question.
You know, what's really interesting about this discussion is you think about something that we celebrate every year, like Lent. And you make a point of this. What would happen if we consumed only what we needed to consume in order to be healthy? If we did that, there would be attendant consequences in all kinds of ways, including economic.
Absolutely. And what that shows us is that you can really build an economy around your vices. In other words, around not having virtue. So I do this exercise pretty much on a yearly basis with my students when Lent rolls around. I ask them just the question you ask, what would happen if we only eat the foods that are good for you and you eat natural foods? That is, you don't eat a bunch of processed foods, but you eat actual things that grew in the ground or close to it. You know, what would happen? Well, one of the things that would happen is an economic chain reaction, which would cause vast mayhem. And what that tells us is that we have figured out a way to have what Plato called a feverish economy, where our overconsumption is actually the thing that runs the economy. And one of the things I tell the students, well, what would happen to the guys that make Doritos and Dorito bags and all the soft drinks and the plastic containers the soft drinks go into? What would happen to all those, you know, high-calorie, high-processed foods in the store? They would just sit there, and you have an economic backlash, and you wouldn't be creating as much trash. So what about the poor trash people? You know, are you going to be laying off people there? What about if people suddenly became healthy? Simply by eating healthy food and exercising, the entire diet industry would collapse. How many doctors would be out of work? Because people really wouldn't need a doctor that much. So one of the things that we have to ask, and again, this is a question not that I'm bringing up, this is as old as Plato who brings it up, is what happens when you find out that your economy, your entire way of life, is really built up on what amounts to certain kinds of vices, like gluttony. We just eat too much. You know, our obesity rates, not just in the United States and worldwide, are through the roof. We have all kinds of health problems because of it. You know, so it's not like it's innocuous. We're suffering for it. But we have an economy built upon our not doing the right things. And a sign of that is if we do act well, act temperately, that's the virtue that is essentially involved in taking in food, we find that we nearly destroy the economy. Then we have to ask ourselves those questions that are hard. Well, how should we be making our economy set up? And we realize, well, gosh, in our little experiment, we certainly created less trash. That was helpful. We became more helpful. But we also threw all those people out of work. So what are we going to do? Are we going to make sure that people have a lot of work by destroying ourselves? Or are we going to figure out a radically new way to live?
We are the number one obesity nation. And we used to talk about years ago the population bomb and how there wasn't going to be enough food to feed people. And now it turns out that obesity is the biggest problem.
Yeah, that's a really weird irony. In order to meet what we thought was the worldwide need for food, we're actually engaged in all kinds of overproduction of foods. And historically, I didn't put this in the book, but it's interesting that historically the snack food industry was literally invented to absorb the excess food that we were producing. So what are you going to do with all that extra sugar and wheat and everything else? Well, you just invent food that people eat over and above what they have to eat to preserve their bodies well. So it's a really odd situation. And as you say, the obesity rates are, and I have information on that in the book, are really embarrassing. And they're evidently self-destructive. Nobody can pretend that it's good for us to destroy our health by eating bad food. It can't be. And this is another way that the natural law arises again. You don't have to become a Christian to see that overeating is a bad thing. It's not good. But that is one of the four cardinal virtues, again, is temperance. And temperance deals with eating the right amount of healthy food and not eating the things that harm you. So, interesting enough, science is discovering the need for virtue, one of the very virtues that Christianity has been telling us for 2,000 years that you need. Well, science has finally caught up with that. You know, and the same would be true for temperance in relationship to sexuality and so on and so on and so on. In other words, the interesting thing is when we really look at the ill effects that we're having, we can realize, well, what would be the good thing to do? And we rediscover the Christian moral tradition.
So there's a direct correlation between the empire of waste and the seven deadly sins that are talked about in Scripture.
Yeah. Well, one of them is, obviously, gluttony, but it's also avarice. You know, if these people know, and I have a section on this in the book, how to create foods that are almost literally unable to be resisted. That is, they have the character of an opioid, that is something that causes addiction. And there's an actual science of it. Now, that's a misuse of science. That's a misuse of our intellect. It's a misuse of our intellect, and it's an immoral misuse. That is, the industries are knowingly creating food that they realize will cause bad habits, which are exactly what an addiction is. And the reason is there's big money in it. So, as I point out once in there, the reason that McDonald's and so on love soft drinks is they have the highest profit margin. And so they want to sell you, I don't know what it's called, the big gulp. You know, it's like a third of a gallon of this stuff. And you think, who would drink that much water? You know, that would be the big drown. But yet, you know, people are just sucking these things down. Well, they're awful for people. And the people that sell them know they're awful. And the result is that people have simply become addicted to having soft drinks or to highly sugared processed foods. So, and the industries know that. So, well, that's one of the seven deadly sins, as you point out. That is greed. That's avarice. They're making millions and millions of dollars. And again, I think the left understands this. They know about it. They say things like this all the time. But when they do that, what they're admitting is there really is something called vice. There really is something called sin. There really is something that by nature you can say, this is bad to do this to people. But if you live in a meaningless universe that's just been constructed by chance, that doesn't really have any bite to it. You know? So they've got to admit that there's an intrinsic morality to the universe, and you're starting to get dangerously close to admitting there's a moral designer of the universe if you do that, which is fine with me.
You sort of alluded to this, but there's a word that you use, and I don't know if you coined the word hyperpalatability. Talk about that word, what it means, and how it relates to, let's say, the Lay's commercial, you just can't eat one of these.
You can't do it, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't coin it. It took me a long time to learn to spell it, actually. I couldn't figure out how. But in the literature, it's an actual scientific term. And it refers to, you know, the level of palatability is the fact that food tastes good, and so you want to eat it. And that's not something that is just intrinsic to human beings. You know, all the animals that eat something like what they eat. That is, it tastes good to them. And if it didn't, they wouldn't eat it. So it's a way to get us to eat. It's a built-in way to get us to eat, and your taste sensation realizes when something is palatable for you. So palatability is a good thing. Now, what's happened is that human beings have been able to create hyperpalatability. That is, a taste that is so incredibly intense that it's literally unnatural and goes beyond what you would find in any kind of a natural food. And then it removes the nutritional substrate. Like, it's all taste and no nutrition. Whereas an apple is palatable, a good one, not these awful ones you sometimes get from the supermarket, but a good apple, it tastes good and it is good. So the nutrition and the tastiness are united. Well, we figured out, clever folks that we are, how to take the tastiness out of it and then intensify it beyond a natural level so that, again, it quite literally it takes hold of our pleasure system in our brain and causes us to crave that super intense, hyper-palatable taste. So when you say, gosh, I just have to have a brownie or whatever it is, it is really a kind of addiction because of what it does to the pleasure center of your brain. And so that's what the industries are trying to do, to get you to want to eat or drink as much of their product as possible.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with ethicist Benjamin Weicker in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receive as our thanks for your gift Benjamin Weicker's book, In Defense of Nature, or any of the other resources mentioned on the broadcast today, call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.